Feeding the Flame by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend. Chapter 9. Remember, the turtle progresses only when he sticks out his neck. Glory be, I thought I had put behind me all discussions of astrals, death, and all that sort of thing, and now here's another load of questions, all bearing on the same thing. For example, does an atomic explosion, which incinerates thousands of human bodies simultaneously, cause pandemonium on the astral plane, or how does it affect or disturb them? It does not do a thing to harm them physically, but it certainly causes an awful flop, because thousands of people are going to come to the astral world in one awful huddle. Many of them will be scared sick. Many will be insane with shock. So, all available helpers are rushed to help those who are pouring in and are in a very distressed state. The scene, actually, would be very much like that when there is a truly bad calamity on Earth, such as an earthquake or something at least as disastrous, where helpers and volunteer helpers rush to use any means possible to lend assistance. The answer, then, is nobody in the astral world is harmed by the detonation of the bomb, but they are very much upset by the extra work in trying to care for so many people all at one time, because, while such an event will have been foreseen, yet all these foreseeings are probabilities and not necessarily actual events which are just bound to occur. The next one asks, how do the menus of nations supervise the affairs of their nation? Do they work through the United Nations representatives, through the heads of the nations, their cabinets and advisors, or how? If the United Nations was as had been hoped, that would have been the way for a menu to work. But here is something that you have to consider very seriously. It may be distasteful to you. It may even be thoroughly shocking to you. But nevertheless, it is actual fact. This particular world is not a very advanced world. Actually, it is a penitentiary world, a hell, a hard school, call it what you will. And many of the menus in charge of this world are themselves learning. As they gain experience and as they become successful, then, just like a departmental manager, they get promoted. And if the general manager can make a success of things in his small branch, then he might well be promoted to a much larger branch. It really is necessary to look at things with an open mind and to remember that when, on the other side, in the astral, one does not sit on a cloud and strum a banjo or pluck the strings of a harp, one has to work. If you are in the kindergarten class at school, you might think that the great big grown-ups of 12 years of age in a class higher are real gods who do nothing except tell the teachers where to go. And these 12 and 14-year-olds might think that the 6th graders or 13th graders or whatever you want to call them are truly gods of creation. But these gods of creation still have to do their homework, still have to attend classes, still have to gain experience. All right, people come to this earth to gain experience. Manus look after this world, more or less, in order to gain experience. And if there are a few fights between countries, well, it's teaching humans, and it's teaching Manus as well. In higher states, that is, with much more advanced worlds, Manus can get together and discuss things amicably, so that there are no wars and no particular crime. But that is much too advanced for the hoodlums of the Earth. The Earth people are here to learn the hard way, because they won't learn in the soft way, the kind way. If a chap comes along and takes a swipe at you with a club or shows an earnest desire to bonk you on the noggin and lay you out, well, it's useless to say, "I pray, my dear fellow, that you will kindly desist from these unwelcome attentions." Instead, if you're wise, you'll kick him where it will do the most harm, and then let out a hoot for the police. So the Manus of this world are learners. They are learning things just as you are, and when they have learned to straighten up things a bit, they will move on to something better. But cheer up. You have to stay only about 70 years or so to a lifetime. The poor Manus have a longer sentence than that, by far. Now, here is a little question tucked in. It is understood that the line of the 13th Dalai Lama was all the same soul. Could the 13th be now, in the land of the golden light, and still reincarnate in the 14th? Well, that is the easiest question of all to answer, because the 14th Dalai Lama himself seems to have spilled the beans to the press and admitted that he is not a reincarnation of the great 13th, which is just as well, because the great 13th is a very active entity indeed in the astral world, doing very much good, and I believe, rather sad that the present leaders in exile in India are not doing much to aid suffering Tibet. But I dealt with that at some length in an earlier chapter of this book, so perhaps I should not gild the lily or repeat myself when I need not. Another person writes in, referring to my Visit to Venus book. But let me state here and now that I definitely do not recommend that book. It is just a few pages containing some articles which I wrote years ago, and it contains some, well, I consider them offbeat illustrations, not done by me. This book, containing parts of my work and filled out with a lot of blurb, was published entirely without my permission and entirely against my wishes. The same applies to a record called The Power of Prayer. I definitely do not recommend it. The quality is exceedingly poor, and it was never meant to be reproduced as a record. It is just something that I made many, many years ago. And when I left North America to go to South America, I was informed that this record had been made without my permission, without my desire, during my absence from the continent. If you want a real record, then purchase the meditation record which I made specially for a record. This was made specially to help people meditate, and it may be obtained from Mr. E. Z. Souter, 33 Ashby Road, Loughborough, Leicestershire, England. And an insert from Blue. It can also be found right on YouTube. I will tell you that Mr. Sauter has world rights for this record and for Touchstones and many other things, and he is the only person who has my full permission and agreement to sell my records and Touchstones. He also sells various other things of my design. That is a free advertisement for Mr. Sauter, who is a very decent man and who is trying to do good. This book is not meant to be a catalogue of nice people. It's not meant to be a catalogue of crummy dopes on the outer fringe of sanity, either. But I cannot let the book be completed without mentioning a very pleasant family indeed. And that is Mrs. Worsman and her two daughters. You may recall that one of my books was dedicated to Mrs. Worsman, a very pleasant, very highly educated woman, whom it is a pleasure to know. And I have known her for several years, known her while her husband was still alive on this earth, and I have been in touch with him now that he is on the other side. Mrs. Worsman, then, is one of the more enlightened types. Certainly she was enlightened enough to have two talented daughters. Louise, who is a nurse in one of the better London hospitals, and she's a good nurse, but she is good at so many things. She is artistic. Well, I'm not going to list all her virtues, but there are too many to put down on these pages. I want to mention her sister also, Therese, another talented one. She also is a nurse, and she's very anxious to train as a surgeon. She has all the capabilities for it, everything except the money, in fact. I've been looking around to see if there were any insurance schemes which would enable a highly gifted young woman to get training as a surgeon. Unfortunately, I have not yet found any such source. So if any of you, my readers, know how to raise money whereby an entirely capable young woman can pay for her training at medical school, then now is your chance to do good. I make it clear, I make it absolutely clear, that this young lady has the ability to do some good for the world as a surgeon, and it seems rather dreadful that she may be deprived of the opportunity of doing that good through lack of money to finance her training. Dealing with the surgeon-to-be, let us deal with heart transplants. I have a question here. What about the current rash of heart transplants and other radical surgery, inserting foreign organs, plastic valves and tubing, etc., into a body? From a purely material physiological standpoint, this seems to be considered an almost miraculous scientific breakthrough, but does it do the trick? Will the use of various chemicals counteract the normal tendency of the body to reject any foreign material introduced into it in this way? Or is such rejection inevitable simply because the substituting of a healthy new organ into a body to replace a diseased member won't result in proper meshing between the still diseased etheric of the organ in question with the artificially introduced material counterpart? And furthermore, is there anything really gained for the individual being operated upon if he has a few months or even years of invalidism added to his present stay on earth, unless he really uses the time gained thereby to learn some really worthwhile lessons which would otherwise have been deferred to another incarnation. Well, that's a mouthful, certainly. Many hundreds of centuries ago, in the days of Atlantis, people could do transplants. It was possible in those days to graft on an arm or a leg, possible to replace hearts and kidneys and lungs, but it was a providential act of nature that a civilization which did such things came to an end. They tried replacing brains, and they produced immoral monsters. Basically, there is nothing very difficult in replacing a heart. It's just a mechanical procedure. You have to cut out the heart, and you have to trim the replacement heart to exactly fit the pipes which are left. Any competent surgeon could do such an operation. In the physical world, one has a semi-invalid. After all, when one does such a radical operation, certain small blood vessels and nerves cannot be rejoined. The whole structure becomes impaired, and so a very sick man is given an added sickness, impairment of his body. But still, such a person could go on for an indefinite number of years, go on living a life of semi-invalidism. In the astral world, however, there are two people who are suffering greatly by being cross-mixed. One person is half in the astral, that is, he goes to the astral world during sleep only, and the other person is right in the astral, but because his heart or other organ is still living, he has a sort of sympathetic attachment through the silver cord of the person who now has that organ. You sometimes get two radios. You switch on two radios in the same room, perhaps on the same program. And if you switch off one, then it does make slightly more volume to the second there is some interaction between the two. And these are only radios, only things which some set of girls put together while they were talking about their latest boyfriends and how many their mini skirts would be the next season. When you get to living humans, the interaction is much, much stronger, and it definitely, very definitely, impairs the efficiency of a person living in the astral world to be even sympathetically connected to the body of another person. It is my firm belief that replacing organs like this is terrible, criminally wrong, and really people should not permit such abuses of nature. The reflections from the donor's heart show up in the aura of the recipient, and the two people may not have been compatible. The fact that one could be colored and the other white has nothing to do with it. The basic rate of vibration, that is, the frequency of each person, has everything to do with it. And I certainly hope that such transplants can be outlawed. It is a different matter if one is replacing an organ with a synthetic organ, because that is no worse than a person wearing glasses or a hearing aid or clothing, no worse than using a crutch. I believe that medical scientists should be encouraged to devise artificial organs which could safely be used on humans. then there would be no cross-linkage between two entities, which causes a handicap to both entities until both are free of their silver cords and living in the astral world. So to answer this specific question, I am definitely opposed to organ transplants. Here's another question which should be of general interest. It is, information or directions on how a few people working devotedly could bring about a change in the course of the world affairs. Well, if a few people would definitely think in step on a specific subject, then whatever they think about could actually be so. Nowadays, people cannot hold a thought for more than a second or two, but if you doubt that, try it yourself. Try and think about one specific subject while watching the second hand of your watch. You will find, if you're honest, that your attention will waver and wander far more rapidly than you would believe possible. Your attention will only stay more or less constant if you are thinking about something to do with yourself, something you want to do, something which affects you deeply. Anything else, such as bringing help to another person whom you have met, well, you cannot hold the interest for very long. People's thought is not constant, and no one thinks of the same thing at the same time with the same intensity. They are like a mass of people milling about, all walking but all out of step. Whereas, if people could think in step, then they could indeed accomplish miracles. If you want to think of this further, consider an army of men. Consider a regiment of soldiers marching over a bridge. If those men marched in step across the bridge, they would destroy it. And for that reason, the men are instructed before going onto the bridge to break their step. So, they go over walking, just as a disorderly rabble would walk, not in step, not in rhythm, and so the building up effect of many men walking in step is destroyed. There isn't the force there any longer, and the bridge is not damaged. If you could get a number of men marching absolutely in step, they would destroy any bridge that could be made, and if one kept up the marching, they could destroy a building also, because the constant pounding down and lifting up would build up such a series of vibrations that the amplitude or degree of vibration would increase and increase beyond the point where the natural elasticity of the bridge or building could encompass it, and then the bridge would just shatter like a broken glass. If one could get, half a dozen people, and get them to think definitely, deliberately, in waves of the correct pattern, they could topple governments or build governments. They could make one country preeminent over all others, and they could do things which now would be regarded as utterly impossible. It is, perhaps, fortunate that it is not too easy to get people to think in unison at exactly the right frequency, because, and I'm telling you this quite seriously, it is not a joke. If one had a gang of crooks who were trained in thinking correctly, they could think open a bank vault. Dear me, What a pity I haven't a nice little gang. It would be very pleasant to have a nice load of money, wouldn't it? Still, it is truly quite possible, and in fact, in Atlantean days, it was an everyday occurrence. The Catholic chants are a relic of those bygone days. Chants which some think are only 2,000 years old, but they are still chants which have been built on the original songs of power of the Sumerians and the Atlanteans. Perhaps I should put it the other way around, Atlanteans and Sumerians, because, of course, the Atlanteans are the oldest civilization of the two. In those days, it was possible to lift massive chunks of stone by thought, by having a trained mass of priests thinking at the same time under their conductor so that the stone would lift straight up in the air. If you think that is too fantastic, remember that you can make a sound which will break a glass. If you sustain the sound, you can break a glass or break a window, and thought is just another form of sound, that is, a vibration. Everything is a vibration, and if you can set the right vibration in motion, you can accomplish anything. Another question. Readers are wondering when will be the proper time for the free world to know of the time capsules. Well, the proper time is not yet. The proper time is not until the end of this civilization. The end of this civilization as we know it at present. Later, oh, not in your lifetime, so don't worry. Much later, there will be earthquakes, which will really shake the crust of the earth, and these time capsules will be thrown up to the surface, ready to be opened. There are quite a number of them. One tremendous capsule is in Egypt. I suppose technically it is a capsule, but actually it is a vast chamber deep beneath the shifting sands of the Egyptian desert. The chamber is an absolute museum of artifacts which existed tens of thousands of years ago. Yes, tens of thousands of years ago. There are aircraft of a very, very different type than those in use now. Aircraft which work by anti-gravity, so that the power of the motor is not expended in supporting the weight, but it is used just to propel the vehicle forward. I will tell you quite truthfully that I have seen such an aircraft. One device would be especially of interest to the housewife or to the person who has to carry weights. It's a sort of handle which attaches to whatever has to be carried, and then one just catches hold of the handle as when one is carrying a basket. If the parcel or bundle is heavy, then the handle is depressed more. If the parcel is not very heavy, then the handle is not very far depressed. Each of these devices was constructed so that no matter whether the parcel weighed a ton or 10 pounds, the person had no more than about a pound of effort to expend. Anti-gravity was a perfectly ordinary, perfectly common thing in centuries long past. But the priests of that day, who also were the leaders of the armies, got a bit cross with each other, and each side tried bigger and better weapons than the other, with the result that they blew their whole civilization into the air, and it came down as a radioactive dust. Later, when these time capsules are opened, television in three dimensions will be seen, and not just 3D by means of two cameras or two lenses, but a thing in which there appear to be actual people, miniature size, of course, acting out plays, dances, and even debates. Photography, too, was different in those days. There were no such things as the flat photographs which we now see. Everything was in the solid, more 3D than 3D itself. The nearest thing is the very, very crude holograms with which scientists are just experimenting, in which you can almost look behind the object you had photographed. Well, in the days of Atlantis, you could look behind. Hundreds of centuries ago, there was the mightiest civilization the world had seen up to that time, but there was such a cataclysm that people became almost demented, those that were left, and they had to start just about from the savage state. And the present so-called age of science has barely reached what would be called the kindergarten stage when Atlantis was at its peak. Many people disbelieve in Atlantis, which, of course, is just utterly foolish. They're like the fishermen who go out fishing, and because they don't catch anything, they say, "Oh, there are no fish in the seas anymore, they've all died off." Yes, there was an Atlantis, and there are living remnants of Atlantis still, deep underground in a certain part of the world. And let me make clear here that that part of the world is not Mount Shasta. Don't believe all the hooey you read or are told about Mount Shasta. This is just an ordinary area which has been over-publicized by people who wanted to make not just a fast buck, but a whole sack of them. I wish I could tell you some of the things I absolutely, definitely know, but there are certain things which cannot be told at present. I know the actual truth about the submarines Thresher and Scorpion, and I know what happened to them and why. The story, if it could be told, would make cold chills run up and down your spine, but the time is not yet. There are many things which could be told, but, well, these books circulate everywhere. Many, many people read them, and there are many people who should not be aware that certain people know what is really going on. You can take it, though, that the mystery of the Thresher and the Scorpion is a stranger thing than you would ever believe. "But you seem so very interested in animals," said the letter, "and yet you say that you do not believe in vegetarianism. Now why is that? How do you reconcile the two, a love of animals and a dislike of vegetarianism?" "I believe, most firmly, that man has a body which at this stage of existence needs meat for its sustenance. Now let me tell you something. Countless years ago, years and years and years ago, there was a form of man who was entirely a vegetarian. He was so busy eating that he had no time for anything else. It never occurred to him to eat meat, and so that he could deal with the tremendous bulk of vegetables, fruits, and nuts necessary, he had an additional organ, the last vestigial remnant of which is the appendix. The experiment was a complete failure. The gardeners of the earth found that vegetarian man was inefficient, because to take in the necessary amount of cellulose matter to enable him to do any worthwhile work was quite a prohibitive matter. He would have been eating all the time, eating for so long that there would not be any time left for him to do any constructive work. And so, the gardeners of the earth scrapped that type of man, or if you don't like the word scrapped, let us say that through evolution, mankind turned into a meat eater. We have to face basic facts, and one of the basic facts is this: all vegetable matter is cellulose supported. Now, you imagine lace curtains, a nice openwork net, and then you stuff the holes with paste stuff containing food substance. Supposing you had to eat the lace curtains in order that the food value packed in the holes could be absorbed into your body. It sounds a bit fantastic, doesn't it? But that's just what you do when you eat a lot of lettuce or cabbage or other vegetable or fruit stuff. What you are eating is a cellulose sponge, the holes of which are packed with food. But the sponge material takes up a lot of room, and so to get an adequate amount of food, one has to take a quite excessive bulk of cellulose. And the poor, wretched body cannot digest cellulose, you know. It has to be excreted. In all my life, I have never, never met a vegetarian who could do any hard work. Of course, if he was sitting on his behind all day, letting other people do the work, then no doubt he could get by. But he wouldn't be very bright. If by any chance he was bright, then you could take it that he lived naturally, he would be a darn sight brighter. Quite truly, have you ever seen a navvy or a person who does hard manual work who could live on vegetables and fruits only? You haven't, have you, now that you come to think of it? But let us get back to our animal business. I am truly an animal lover. I love all animals, and I can assure you that animals know they have to die sometime, and it helps their own karma if they can die for a useful purpose. Animals who are raised for food are looked after. They are bred carefully, and any sickness is treated. The herd is very carefully supervised so that there are only healthy animals. In the wild state, you get animals who are diseased or stunted or who have been injured in some way, or even those who have some disease such as cancer or lung trouble, and they just have to drag out a miserable existence. Supposing an animal breaks a leg, then it has to live out a really miserable existence until it dies in pain and starvation. Yet any herd animal would be cared for immediately. If no one killed any animals, then soon the world would be overrun with animals of every type. There would be cattle in large numbers, and the greater the number of cattle, then the greater the number of predator animals, which nature herself would provide to keep down the number of cattle. If humans eat meat, then it's to their advantage to kill an animal painlessly and quickly. In killing an animal for food, one is also keeping down the number of animals and keeping them in check so that in growing to uncontrollable numbers and in running wild, the stock does not become downgraded. Now, whether we like it or not, Humans also have to be kept in check so far as their numbers are concerned. If there are too many humans, then inevitably there's a big war, or a serious earthquake, or some sort of plague or illness which carries off large numbers of humans. That is just the gardeners of the earth thinning out the ranks, cutting down on surplus people. People, after all, are just animals of a different type. And all the people who fairly yowl with anguish at the thought of a person eating a piece of beef, well, how about eating a live lettuce? If one eats a piece of beef or chicken, the original owner of the flesh is no longer able to feel the bites. Yet people go and eat live lettuce. They eat live pears. So how do they reconcile their so-called humanitarian principles? Science, cynical and skeptical though it may be, has now discovered that plants have feelings. Plants will grow better when they're tended by people who are sympathetic to them. Plants respond to music. There are instruments which can indicate how much pain a plant is enduring. You may not hear a cabbage shriek when you tear off its outer leaves. No, because it has no vocal cords. And yet there are instruments which can record that shriek of pain as a burst of static. This is not fairy tale stuff. It's actual fact. It's stuff that has been investigated and proved again. In research laboratories in Russia, England, and the USA, it has been proved. When you pick some berries and stuff them in your mouth, well, how about the feelings of the plant? You don't go and tear a lump off a cow and stuff it in your mouth, do you? If you tried to, the cow would soon object. But because a plant cannot make its pain known, you think you're a jolly, wonderful humanitarian when you eat plants instead of meat, which cannot feel the pain of being eaten. Quite frankly, I believe that vegetarians are a lot of cranks and crackpots, and if they would only come off their stupid attitudes and remember that the gardeners of the earth designed their bodies for certain food, then they would be a lot better in their mental health. If you have a car, you wouldn't drain the sump and fill it up with water, would you? And say, you couldn't possibly use oil because it might come from the earth somewhere and hurt somebody underground. If you try to run your body on food for which it is not designed, you are being just the same as a person who won't use oil in the sump of his car, but instead uses salt water. If we're going to be logical, and if we're going to say that vegetarianism is good, then how about the practice of using cut flowers in one's rooms? Plants are living entities, and when you cut flowers, you're cutting off the sex organs of the plants and sticking them in vases. And actually, humans would be shockingly unhappy if their sex organs were cut off and stuck in vases for some different race to enjoy. Let me digress here to say that when I was in hospital, I received a very pleasant surprise. A group of very kind ladies, as far away as the Pacific coast of the USA, had wired to a florist in the city of St. John to have some plants delivered to me at the hospital. I appreciated it very much indeed. The ladies did not give any address, but I was able to locate them. A personal choice? I do not like cut flowers. It seems to me such a pity to cut them off. Instead, I very much prefer a complete plant. Here one has a living thing which is growing and not just dying. I often think people who send great bunches of cut flowers, well, why not cut off the heads of small children and impale them on sticks and put those in a room? Have you ever thought of the state of this old earth of ours is in? It's quite a mess, you know. Compare it to a garden. Now, if the garden is properly maintained, there are no weeds or anything like that. All pests are kept in check. There is no blight on the trees, and the fruits are full and healthy. Plants have to be thinned out. The sickly ones have to be removed. Every so often, fruit trees have to be pruned. Sometimes there are grafts taken. It is necessary to carefully supervise the garden and to prevent cross-pollination between undesirable species. If the garden is maintained as it should be, it becomes a thing of beauty. But let the gardeners go away. Let the garden remain idle for a year or two. Weeds will grow and will choke and kill off the more delicate plants. Unchecked pests will come, and blight will appear on the trees. No longer will there be round, fresh fruits, but soon they will be shriveled and wrinkled with all sorts of brown spots. A sadly neglected garden is a tragic sight. Or let us go from garden to livestock. Have you ever seen wild ponies on a moor, or wild cattle where the grazing is poor? They become stunted. Some of them suffer from rickets. Many suffer from skin diseases. Generally, they are a pretty pathetic sight, little dwarf creatures, unkempt and very, very wild. Look at a well-maintained stockyard. Here you see pedigree animals, carefully bred, faults bred out of them, in fact. You get fine pedigree horses or excellent pedigree cows. They're healthy. They are large and substantial looking. They appear glad to be alive, and you can look at them with pleasure, knowing that they are not going to shy away from you in fright. They know they are looked after. Now think of the earth. Think of the people here. The stock is getting poorer and poorer. People are becoming more vicious. People are listening to more depraved music and watching ever more obscene pictures. Now it is no longer an age when beauty and spirituality count. No longer do people love good music, love good pictures. Everything is being torn down. You cannot get a great man without some moronic clot trying to say unkind things about him. One of the greatest men of modern times, Sir Winston Churchill, probably saved the world from being under the cloud of communism. Yet even Sir Winston Churchill had his detractors just because of the spirit of evil which pervades the atmosphere nowadays. The garden, which is the earth, which is our world, has gone to seed. Weeds grow aplenty. You can see them in the streets with their long hair and dirty complexions, and if you can't see them, you can jolly well smell them yards away. The races need pruning. Stock needs replenishing. And soon will come the time when the gardeners of the earth come back for their periodical inspection and find conditions here to be quite intolerable. Something will be done about it. Mankind will not be left to go to bad seed as it has of late. There will come a time when all the races of man will unite, when there will no longer be black people and white people and yellow and red people. The whole world will be peopled by the race of tan, and that will be the predominating color, tan. With the coming of the race of tan, there will be much fresh life injected in the human race. People will again value the better things of life. People will again value spiritual things. And when mankind gets spiritual to a sufficient degree, it will be possible for mankind once again to talk by telepathy with the gods, the gardeners of the earth. At present, mankind has sunk in the swamp of despondency, sunk in his own lack of spirituality, sunk so low that his basic vibrations are reduced to such an extent that he cannot be heard telepathically by any creature, not even by his fellows. But the time will come when all that will be remedied. I'm not trying to sell you Buddhism, nor Christianity, nor Judaism, but I am saying quite definitely that there will have to be a return to some form of religion, because only religion can give one the necessary spiritual discipline which will convert an unholy rabble of humanity to a disciplined spiritual group of people who can carry on the race instead of having it plowed under and a fresh set of entities placed here. Now, in the present state of dissonance, even Christians fight against Christians. The war in Northern Ireland between Catholics and Protestants, it doesn't matter who's right or who's wrong. They are both alleged to be Christians. They're both alleged to follow the same religion. Does it matter whether one sect crosses himself with the left hand while the other does it with his right? It's much the same as one of the stories in Gulliver's Travels, where the people of one mythical country went to war about which end of an egg should be opened first, the small end or the broad end. How can Christianity possibly try to convert other nations, other religions, when Christians fight against Christians? Because both Catholics and Protestants are Christians. End of chapter 9.